You're listening to the Passion City Church DC podcast. To learn more about Passion City Church, including our gathering times in Atlanta and Washington, D.C., visit us online at PassionCityChurch.com. Today's talk comes from Pastor Ben Stewart.
Well, I was the director of a ministry on the campus of Texas A&M for 10 years. And as the director of that ministry, I was, with some degree of regularity, accused of not being truly saved. And it would work out this way. Inevitably, a teacher would arrive in town with a new derivation of Christianity that would kind of skim off a certain percentage of college kids. And inevitably, they would teach them some unique expression of Christianity. And then those acolytes of that person would inevitably trickle back towards Breakaway and tell me, hey, you're not really saved because you weren't baptized the right way. Or because you didn't say the right words when you came to faith. Because you didn't repent of all known sin in your mind at the moment of conversion, you're not truly saved. Because you didn't pass out tracts, gospel tracts at Walmart in the parking lot at 2 a.m., you're not truly saved. Or they would say, you're not truly saved because you've never raised someone from the dead. You have not ushered in an experience where gold dust falls from the ceiling, or you've not had golden teeth arrive in your mouth. You've not had an ecstatic emotional experience where you've passed out and woken up with a revelation. You've not experienced some of these things. And inevitably that would happen. They would say, so you're not a real Christian. Or maybe you are a Christian, but you're junior varsity, but I've now attained varsity. And inevitably, the way they would discern that kind of broke along these two camps, either your failure in performance or your failure in experience. You have failed to do some things, so you're not real. Or you've not experienced some things, and therefore you're not real. What they inevitably never focused on was character, something God is very interested in. Am I shaping, carasso, etching your heart so that you're more loving, more kind, more generous, have more integrity, have greater wisdom in decisions? It wasn't about God forming your character. It was about, have you done X or experienced Y? And if you haven't done this or experienced this, then you're not real. And inevitably, these would blow into a college campus and find some root, because college students often have a great deal of zeal, but not a lot of wisdom. A new flowering faith, but that's shallow in the soil, so easy to pick up and transplant. And it would upset the faith of some, and inevitably it would burn out these different cycles that would blow through. They would kind of burn themselves out, but not without doing some damage to some young people. And I mention all that because that's Paul's concern here. The church of Colossae, Paul didn't plant it. One of his disciples did. And it's a young, fledgling church. It's a church that's growing. You see people coming to faith in Christ. And then as they begin to grow, a teaching comes in that begins to try to skim off some of them and upset them. Let me change what it is to really know God. And it's upsetting the faith of some. So Paul's trying to help them understand the difference between this experience and what is truly real. But you need to understand, because this is true for all of us, whenever God is moving in power, crazy moves in next door. Whenever you see God move in power and you see power flowing, people want to come and sort of skim off some of that energy. I remember Donna and I, we went to New Orleans several years ago, and we brought a friend, and it was Donna and I's second time to go, and we told this friend, oh my gosh, there's this place in the French Quarter, they serve beignets. It's this dessert that will change your life. And so we wanted her to experience this amazing dessert, and so we were walking down to the French Quarter, and I was trying to navigate by memory. I was like, no, I remember it was over here. I remember it was down in this area. And as I got there, I saw the familiar green and white awning and saw big signs that said beignets. I was like, that's it. I saw the exterior, and so I walked up to it, and then when I got there, I was like, I swear it was on the other side of the street, though. But I mean, here it is. Says beignets, green and white. Here's the deal. I was like, I don't know. Let me just look. And so I crossed the street, and there across the street was Café du Monde, the real place I was looking for, famous for this fantastic dessert. And then I realized, so who's this guy? And I realized, oh, he saw all this dessert action and was like, okay, green and white, I got you. Okay, fry it up, sure. And he was, what was he doing? Getting the exterior trappings, but a different substance within. My family, the kids had spring break a couple weeks ago, so we went out to this cabin, kind of out in the woods to just have peace. And when we went there, as soon as we got there, these geese came flying in and they're honking, which was kind of echoing through this little valley where they kind of landed on this pond. And we're like, that's nuts. And I'm showing my five-year-old son, like, look at these geese, that's so cool. And then we walked in the house and I hear him yell, Dad, there's a goose in the house. And so we walked in the house and there was a stuffed goose. And so he's like, whoa, but then he's coming up to it like, and he touches it and he was like, Dad, is this a goose? And I said, yes, but no. And he was like, it's got real goose fur. I was like, we call those feathers, son. And he was like, is this a goose? And I'm trying to explain to him, yes, it is a goose. He's like, well, why is it not honking? Why is it not walking? And I was like, all right, let's go there. Son, it's a goose in the external skin, but someone's ripped all the guts out and put something else inside. And he said, what's inside? Sawdust, newspaper, dead things. I said, so yes, it's a goose in the sense that it has the external trappings of the goose. It looks like a goose, but on the inside, there's no life. And what Paul is warning them is saying, hey, someone's coming to you with a version of spirituality that looks wise and looks alluring and looks good and looks a lot like the real. That's why this passage can be hard to explain. He said, but if you go down that road, there's no life there. It's a taxidermist model. They've cut out the heart. Religion is not ultimately about performance or experience. It's about intimacy and relationship with God. And there's a very subtle but profound difference that we need to see here. So Paul warns them in verse 16. He says, therefore, let no one pass judgment on you. Don't let anyone stand in judgment over you in questions of food and drink or with regard to a festival or a new moon or a Sabbath. These are a shadow of things to come, but the substance belongs to Christ. Now, there's a lot of debate on what was the nature of the philosophy in Colossae. We'll kind of get to it as we look at the text. Some people say, was it Gnosticism, which was more of a second century idea? But here, I think what you're seeing is a syncretism, and I'll explain it in a minute. But what you're seeing here is there in Colossae, which was a Gentile city, they're grabbing these restrictions. You have to perform certain things. Namely, you have to adapt your diet, and you have to observe certain religious days, right? And the diet part was not necessarily taken exactly from the Old Testament. There were food restrictions of the people of God in the Old Testament. Drink, not as much, except for the extreme Nazirite vow. But these holy days are Jewish holy days. So what you get the idea of is these Colossian teachers were taking elements of the Old Testament ceremonial law and saying, hey, if you're legit, you're not eating that. If you're legit, you are eating this. If you're legit, you're restricting your body. If you're legit, you actually observe these holy days. That's how the real people do it. And they start to put on this qualifier. If you're not doing this certain performance, then you're not real. And Paul says, don't let them stand over you and judge like that. They can't judge you without your acceptance of their judgment. Don't let them do it. He says, but they're judging based on what you do, right? Manipulating your activity. And here's the thing about that. There's an allure to this in the human experience that we need to understand. Years ago, a man by the name of Dan Harris had climbed through the ranks of the newsrooms of America and was in his journalism stream and was able, through hard work, to ascend to getting a spot on ABC's Good Morning America. And he was there, this is the big time, millions of eyes watching them. And there, as he went to deliver a report on live television, he had a full-blown panic attack. Started to say words that didn't mean make any sense, string them together, had a complete breakdown. They had to cut away from it. It's a humiliating experience for him. And it kickstarted for him a journey of trying to understand, like, what happened to me and what's going on? And it was more of an existential crisis of, like, what's wrong with me and what's wrong with us and how's it dealt with? And so he went on this journey of sort of trying to understand spiritually, I don't feel right, so what do I need to do? What do I need to do to be okay? And he went to a Christian pastor and realized there was a lot about Christianity he misunderstood, was really attracted to this pastor. It then came out the pastor was having an ongoing affair and on drugs, and the mismatch of message and lifestyle led him to start pursuing other things, which is a tragedy. But he began to just kind of move into, at the time, what was very popular spirituality movement. So he records in a book he wrote about it, 10% Happier, going to Eckhart Tolle, who was showing him how to do certain things to tap into the spiritual world to be blessed. And he said, you know, he would say things that really made sense, and then he said things that made me wonder if he was sane. He said, so I could tell he was sincere, I couldn't tell if he was sane. And then he went and hung out with Deepak Chopra and spent some time with him and his version of spirituality. You have to do these things to tap into the universe, to access its power, to accomplish good in your life. And so he said, I was doing these things. And he said, I saw in him, he said he lived in a perpetual state of bliss, but I watched him get irritated and angry and yell at people. And he was like, if that's what bliss is, I guess I'm in bliss too. Like, that doesn't seem right. He said, and then as I journeyed with him, I saw, man, he is just moving books and cold remedies and all kinds of different stuff. He said, man, he's talking spirituality, but it looks like salesmanship. He's like, I don't know. He said, with that card, I could tell he's sincere. I didn't know if he was sane. He's like, with Deepak, I could tell he was sane, but I didn't know if he was sincere. And so then he began to journey into other spiritualities where trying to understand, like, maybe I need to sweat in a sweat lodge to find truth, or maybe I need to access an uncomfortable position, which kickstarts a vision. How do I do this? But he was just trying in this search of his to find, what do I need to do to feel okay? Because I feel dislocated with the universe. And as I was reading this, I was like, you know what, man, that is ancient in our DNA as humans. I mean, you see it in the Old Testament as the people of God moved into the region where they settled the promised land. You saw people doing that. They were like, I need crops and I want health. Crops I could sell for money, for goods and services, and to eat and keep me alive. So I need health and I need wealth. And there's certain things I can do, but there's a lot of things out of my control that I can't handle. So there must be gods that are handling it. And so what do I need to do to get the gods to bless me to be okay? So I'll sacrifice some food, I'll restrict myself physically, and that's what you saw in the Baal worship and Ashtoreth worship, and then it progressed into Moloch worship where you're going, how do you know if you're ever done? How do you know if you're ever done enough to be okay? If you get on that ramp, I gotta do things to be okay, how do you know if you're ever done? Well, you're never done until you get all the stuff you want. So if you haven't got it yet, you gotta keep going. And so they sacrifice food and they'll sacrifice animals, and then inevitably it moved to Moloch where you would sacrifice humans. I will burn up a child to try to ensure blessing and fertility on the land and on my body. And when you see that, you go, wow, man, the missionary John Patton, centuries later, went to the island of the New Hebrides and saw people there. He said they were obsessed with fear of the animating spirits, the spirits out there. So they had developed a bunch of taboos, things you can't do, things you shouldn't do, but they were constantly sacrificing things and doing things to try to placate the deities to be blessed. You saw it in ancient Rome. The reason Christians were killed in ancient Rome was not because they loved Christ. You can love whatever God you want. Just make sure and worship all of them. Because there's a God for rain, and there's a God for the ground, and there's a God for sex, and there's a God for all kinds of things. You gotta make them all happy, because if they're mad, they're not gonna give us what we need. And so you gotta do it. And so when the Christians said, I'm not worshiping those gods, they were like, what are you doing? You're gonna get us in trouble. And that's why Romans would kill Christians, to placate the gods. And you saw it when De Las Casas, Franciscan monks went to what was the Americas. They saw 80,000 human bodies sacrificed to the God of the sun to placate him. The God of the rain demanded the sacrifice of children only after you made the child cry. And you see, multiple continents, the Saxons did the same thing. Human sacrifice to Thunor when the Christian went to convert the blonde pagan. And so you see in Africa and in Europe and in America and down near Australia, throughout centuries, human beings, we sense that we're not okay, so we gotta do things to be okay. And if I never feel okay, then I just keep doing stuff, and then it just gets more extreme and more extreme and more extreme. And you see, when you read the Bible affirms, you're not okay. You see in Genesis chapter 3, our first parents broke faith with God. And when we severed from the head, God said, you have become dislocated from the world. You won't feel in touch with nature anymore. You'll feel dislocated from your own body. You'll get sick and you'll die. You'll feel dislocated from each other. You'll have trouble with human relationships. You're going to feel dislocated at every area because you are. But then in that moment, he says, but not here's what you need to do. He says, I am sending a boy to crush the head of the serpent while his heel is struck. God's solution is not what you must do, but what he will do. And so the expectation in Genesis is for a boy to arrive. And God sacrifices an animal to clothe our first parents. And so you see sacrifice early in the Old Testament that they see, I'm not okay. Someone has to pay for it, but I can't. Someone must. And so then you see in Noah's day, Noah's dad names him Noah. It means rest. He says, maybe he's the boy that will give us the rest from the curse. I feel dislocated in the world. Maybe my boy will be the one who makes us right. And Noah wasn't. He was a picture of him, but he wasn't him. God tells Abraham, through your seed, I'm going to bless the whole world. Move to this particular piece of real estate right in the middle of the whole world. And so from there, you can be a beacon of my message to the nations. And then he gives them a law. I'm going to make you look different. You're going to wear different clothes, have different hairstyles, eat different things. I'm going to establish the law that will make you weird. And then I will bless you like crazy. And so when the world turns to you, they say, what are you doing? They say, we take a full day of rest off of work. Why? Because God must work for us. We sacrifice these animals and then we eat it as a family, as a barbecue. Why? Because we know someone else has to pay for our sin. But when we partake of it, we get to have fellowship, communion. That's what a meal is with God. And live into all these symbols. And Paul will say of all those Old Testament ceremonial symbols, the fast, the holy days, food and drink, Paul says they're a tutor to lead you to Christ, literally a pedagogue. It's like a nanny. He said all these little pictures were meant to be this guy grabbing your hand and saying, come on, come on, now meet the real. That's why when Jesus showed up on the scene, John the Baptist said, behold, there is the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. We've been sacrificing lambs as a picture of, I know I'm dislocated. I know I'm not okay. Someone has to make me okay. He says, but that's the Lamb that God provides. And he's not just going to cover your sin. He's going to take it away. And he's not just going to take away his tribe's sin. He's taking away everybody's. So you don't do a thing. Watch what he does. And you see, Jesus Christ steps in to be the perfect sacrifice for you and me, to live the perfect life we could not, to die the death we deserved, rise and beat death. And so Paul says, all that came before was a shadow of the things to come. All the sacrifices and the day of rest and the food restrictions, so that we could partake of the broken body and shed blood of Christ through communion, that we could be communing with him, that his sacrifice would cover us to move sin out of the way. All these things were a picture of the real. They were a shadow. He's the body. When I meet the body, I don't talk to your shadow. I don't lean around you and go, hey, what's up, dog? And start talking to your shadow. You're like, no, like, I'm talking to you. And so here, all the ceremony of the Old Testament was to lead you to the Son. Not what you must do, but what we have done. Religion says do to be okay. Christ says, I have done it. I've done it all. It is done. It is finished. Christ has won. That's what we sing. He did it all. He paid for it all. And so if you feel dislocated from the world, it's because you are. But God has stepped in and done something decisive about it that you could not do. And so you feel a sense of dislocation because you got it. And yet you can't ever placate enough to be at peace with the world. That's why God had to come down and do it for you. And he did. And that's why we sing. We sing to a God who did it all, paid it all. So Paul looks at this fledgling church and says, so don't go back. Jesus Christ paid it all. And these guys are like, yeah, but if you're really spiritual, you won't eat these kinds of meat. And he's like, stop, stop. It's not Christ plus a different sandwich. It's Christ. Don't belittle his sacrifice that way. Now, you want to eat healthy? You eat healthy. You do it. If you're like, I don't like to eat these certain foods, knock yourself out. I think pork's dirty, fine. But to say, and thus I'm on a higher spiritual plane than you, no, no. Only one man put us on that higher spiritual plane, what he did. Don't try to step into his zone. He did it for us, right? So religion has been used to do a lot of bad to people, to tyrannize them. That's why some people gave up on church. You always have to do, and it's never enough. You go, yeah, that's religion. That's not Christ. Religion is do to be okay. Christianity is, it's done. You're okay. That's profound. It's very different. So if someone comes and tries to say, yeah, but if you're really spiritual, you do X, Y, and Z, you say, hey, don't try to disqualify me of my prize. My prize is him, and he purchased freedom for me. Now, you may change your lifestyle to position yourself to enjoy that intimacy with him differently, but that's profoundly different than doing things to earn his smile, right? Let no one disqualify you, verse 18. Disqualify means to be an umpire, to call you out. Let no one disqualify you, insisting on asceticism and worship of angels. That word asceticism is weird. In Greek, it's the word humility, which we go, well, humility is a good thing, right? Like you want to be humble. But it's not speaking of the character of humility. And we know that because it combines here with humility and the worship of angels. And then at the bottom in verse 23, he says, self-made religion and same word, humility and severity to the body. So you get the idea of there's another way to understand humility in Greek, and that is I position my body in uncomfortable places to try to placate some God, or I position myself in some place uncomfortable to try to accomplish something. So it's not that internal humility of not being proud that we want. It's talking about a physical restricting of myself. And then they tie it to the worship of angels, going on in details about visions. And that's a weird sentence. It's going on the worship of angels. It could either be worshiping angels or trying to ascend to worship with the angels. And going on about what he's seen upon entering is what it says in Greek. It's a weird word. Entering into explaining it, or they believe they entered a higher plane. And I think the best commentators understand what's happening here is syncretism. Syncretism is, I like a little bit of this religion. I like a little bit of this one. I'll take a little bit of that one. You ever heard about people doing this? They used to do it centuries ago. You can do it all the time now. Like a little bit of this. I kind of chant that. I wear this crystal every now and again. I read this horoscope, but I also read my Bible. And like we kind of mixed up. And he says they're taking some Jewish spirituality because it looks cool. It's got the good trappings. But they're using this physical discomfort to try to kickstart an ecstatic experience. So it's not just performance, it's also experience. They're kind of merging the two and saying, if I physically discomfort myself, I can kickstart an ecstatic experience. And then I come to you and say, hey, I've truly met with God. And so you're doomed to read a book. I actually went up there and met them. So now let me tell you, as someone who stands on a higher plane, what's what? And Paul says, don't let them do that. Don't do that. No. That's not how this works, right? People do this kind of stuff today. Let me position myself physically uncomfortably to kickstart a spiritual experience. Let me go to a sweat lodge and sweat till it kickstarts a spiritual experience. Am I saying it's wrong to have a profound spiritual experience? No. Paul did. Told the Corinthians about it. Profound spiritual experience, right? And yet, I think we're going to see in the text, there's a difference between experiencing them and pursuing them. And the problem with the pursuit of experience is it tends you to lead you away from the pursuit of a person. And that's profoundly different. That's dangerous. And so here they're using asceticism to kickstart this ecstatic experience of worship where suddenly they're seeing visions. And he says they're puffed up. You know, they'd been talking about how they have the fullness of wisdom. And he's like, no, they're just puffed up with a sensuous mind. It's a spirituality that's so obsessed with a sensory experience, it becomes not spiritual, it's about your body. What did I feel? What did I experience? It sounds spiritual, but it's really sensual. And then he says, the problem is it's not holding fast to the head. He says, there's this obsession with my physical experience. It's interesting, I'm not promoting my book, but my book on dating, for some reason on Amazon, is on under the category of religious encyclopedias. Which I just love that. I don't know why. I don't know who makes those decisions. But I'm like, yes, I wrote an encyclopedia on dating. That's what I did. That's what I've chosen to do with my life. But it puts it in a fascinating category. And I just love seeing what books are also considered religious encyclopedias. Case for Christ, I'm always happy to see selling well because I think it's a great book. The Apocrypha, which I'm like, yeah, sure, read The Apocrypha. That's great. But then I'm always jockeying for position with the encyclopedia of spiritual plants that you can access different plants to accomplish something spiritual in your life, or with crystals. If I can access that harness the energies of certain crystals, I can align with the universe. I'm always kind of sort of jockeying for position with these things that say, let me manipulate something physical to accomplish something spiritual and placate some kind of spiritual world to access power. And Paul says that's a dangerous thing because one, are you worshiping angels? He looked 2 weeks ago and he said, are you trying to placate the elemental spirits of the world? That's what he said later. He said, Christ is Lord over those spirits. Are you trying to harness the energies of the elemental spirituals of the world? He rules over them. And the evil ones, he stamped out. You don't need to be afraid of evil spirits anymore. And the good ones, he rules over them. So if you have Christ, don't run after an experience somewhere else. You've got the real. Don't settle for the shadow. And yet the shadow will often look alluring. It just will. To me, I think of it like a husband who's married and sees a cute girl walk by and says, ooh, maybe a sexual experience with her will be deeply satisfying. And so they decouple from their marriage to have that experience. Not realizing if you do that, what did you just let go? You let go of someone who promised to love you for better or worse. You let go of holidays with your children. You weren't thinking about that. And there's a cost here. And that experience will fade. What did it cost you? You left the real. Now, does God forgive and restore and heal and use people who've experienced that? Yes, God is a God of redemption and all of us are a mess. And so I'm not judging, condemning anyone in this place. God loves to write beautiful stories out of broken people. That's the business he's in. And yet you have to say this decision has a cost. And here Paul is saying spiritually, it's the same way. You'll be walking with Christ, growing with him, and there'll be a spiritual fad that goes by. He goes, oh, but it seems like that dude does have a gold tooth. Or it seems like, oh man, but it seems like they are more disciplined than me. Or it seems like that person did think positively and then win a bunch of money. Maybe I should do that. But Paul says, here's the danger, and here's where we're gonna close in verse 19. Not holding fast to the head from whom the whole body, nourished and knit together through its joints and ligaments, grows with a growth that's from God. He says, here's the danger. If you pursue a performance for an experience, watch yourself. Because if you do that, you might just be severing yourself from the head. Watch if a spirituality moves through your life. How much do they cherish Jesus? How much do they talk about him? Linger in the stories about him? Live with him? Or is it just about spirituality in a general sense? Is it just about stoic discipline techniques to be a more efficient person? If it's just about performance or just about experience, you be careful you're not led away from the head. And it's a careful distinction I'm making here, but it makes all the difference in the world. If I reduce my marriage to I perform certain tasks to get certain experiences, I do X, Y, and Z, and now we shall have sex. I think my wife would be like, what? No, what are you doing? Yes, I do perform things, and yes, we do experience things that are fun. But if I reduce our relationship to that, I've made it a taxidermist model of the real. It's got the external trappings, but it's lost its soul. And yes, as a Christian, you do things, but you do them to promote intimacy with the God who loves you, because your forgiveness is done. And you may experience things. You may see him heal. You may see him move in power. You may have a powerful time of worship with him, and I hope you do. But as I pursue Donna, we have great experiences together. I don't pursue experiences and try to manipulate her to fit it, and that makes all the difference in the world. One is manipulative, the other's beautiful. Don't sever from the head. Because if you fall for this counterfeit spirituality, which I love that Paul doesn't name it, because the truth is it's constantly changing names and changing throughout cultures. But this kind of spirituality, if it's leading you away from the head, he says it's leading you away from the growth that's from God. It's going to promise a growth. He said, but look at it. It's powerless to stop the indulgence of the flesh. Look at your people that have done this, that are always on the latest fad. Does it ever stop the indulgence of the flesh, or does it just redirect it? There was an old movie, Uncle Buck, which I remember that movie, John Candy, told his family triumphantly, "I quit smoking cigarettes." All right, that's great. He was like, "Yes, I'm on to cigars." And after cigars, I'm moving to pipes, then nicotine gum, then back to cigarettes. He said, "I'm on a 5-year cycle." And you see them go, "Oh, okay." Like, suddenly it doesn't feel like a win, right? And it's the same idea. If you just say, "Hey, I quit sinning in this way, but now I'm sinning in this way. Hey, I quit acting out in this way, but now I'm just insufferably proud." If you see people sort of moving from one fad to the other, but they're never improving as a person. "Hey, you're always coming to me with the latest spiritual book, but you're still not a good listener. You're still not humble. You're still not peaceful. I'm not seeing your character change. What good is this doing? And does it have any value in stopping the indulgence of the flesh?" I want you to grow. That impulse for resolve is good in every human being, Christian or not. And yet many are going to techniques and tactics and experiences that at the end of the day aren't helping them grow. And he says, don't sever yourself from the head, because look at it. "For whom the whole body, nourished and knit together through its joints and ligaments, grows with the growth that's from God." The head there, he's talking about Christ, because he said earlier, Christ is the head of the body, that is the church. This isn't a long letter, and he said it a few verses before. So that's what he's telling you. Christ is the head of his body, those who put their faith in him. And so he's the head in the sense that where he goes, we're meant to go. Heads direct bodies. But here you see in the context, it's also a head like headwaters. Where does the life and vitality of a river come from? It comes from its headwaters. If you stop up the head, the river will cease to flow. And he says, don't step out of the stream of the blessings of God to chase a fad. It's just going to lead you to the desert. Stay in the flow of the headwaters. Stay in with Christ. Stay linked up to him. Stay rooted in his word and stay rooted in his community. Do you see that? Christ is the one who nourishes you as you read his word. Christ is the one who knits you together with his people. Faddish spirituality tends to rip religious communities apart. But when we're united in Christ, we work through our differences together, and we grow together, we understand together, and knit together, we become all that we're meant to be under God. But let me just tell you something. Growth, that word, it's not a sexy word. Farming is not sexy. And I'm sorry, I know I just offended a farmer out there that's like, "Hey, how dare you? I'm not saying you're not a sexy farmer. I don't know you. I'm saying the act of farming is not a particularly sexy act, okay? It's not glamorous, right? It's I drop a seed in the dirt, and I water it, and I pull up weeds, and then I have to wait through some things that I can't control. I can't make the winter stop. I can't make the rain come. I can't make the sun go. I can't do so much. I gotta wait. It's uncomfortable. But I wait, and over time, if I stay at it and don't quit, a crop shows up. And if I stay at it and don't quit, more crops come up, and I begin to turn that wheel, and over time, I see growth. Whereas someone who plants a seed and is like, "This is lame," and goes to that field or that field or that field, at the end of the days, you haven't grown at all. And so he says, hey, Christian growth sometimes doesn't look that fantastic. Sometimes it does. Sometimes we worship and it's like heaven rips open and it's bananas. Other times it looks more like farming. Think, all right, good job, guys. Okay, let's get a break on three. Like, that's it. That's all you get today. But if you keep growing and don't leave, you'll keep growing. And you'll look up in a year from now and say, you know what? I'm more patient. My boss said a rude comment, and rather than absorbing it and just letting resentment fuel, I just let it bounce off and I prayed for their redemption. Man, I'm more patient. When my kid was acting crazy, I used to just yell like, how dare you? Now I'm trying to go after their soul and understand what's happening and love them. Hey, now when something doesn't go my way, I pray more. Hey, at the end of the day with my stress, I'm not taking it to a substance. I'm taking it to the King. Sometimes it was imperceptible. Sometimes I didn't even notice it, but I'm looking up and realize I'm growing. And sometimes there's an event. I show up in a worship service and boom, I am never the same again. Other times it's like the slow growing of a harvest. I didn't even see the flowers were beginning to bloom until suddenly they exploded in life. Christian, don't exchange the substance for the shadow. There's much that looks like Christianity, but you stay rooted to Christ. You stay fixed on him. Will there be things we do? We're about to look at them in the book. Will there be things we experience? Oh Lord, let it be. But our pursuit and our focus is him. We will stay knit together with the head who knits us together with us, because that's where the growth of God is found, in the Son of God, Jesus Christ.
If you were encouraged by today's talk, be sure to rate us and hit subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, and wherever you stream your podcasts. To experience other talks, videos, and live gatherings, visit us online at PassionCityChurch.com or download the Passion Movement app. And again, thanks for listening to the Passion City Church DC podcast.